Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network's Middle East Studies podcast. I'm Ruben Silverman, a researcher at Stockholm University's Institute for Turkish Studies, and with me is Elise Mastercard. Professor Mastercard is a senior researcher at the National Center for Scientific Research. Her first book, The Alevis in Turkey and Europe, Identity and Managing Territorial Diversity, was published in 2012. In addition, she has co-edited several collected volumes, including, most recently, Contemporary Populists in Power. Today, we will be discussing her new book, Street-Level Governing, Negotiating the State in Urban Turkey, by Stanford University Press, which looks at mukhtars, local elected officials in Turkey who carried a variety of bureaucratic functions and, therefore, occupy an intriguingly hybrid position in Turkey's political landscape. So, first, I'd like to welcome you, Professor, and ask you if you can tell us a little bit about your background. What brought you to the study of Turkey in general, and mukhtars more specifically?
Yes, thank you for these questions. I began working on actually studying Turkology and political science together. And the reason why I was interested in Turkology, Turkish studies, is I was interested in the Middle East and was actually seem to be very close to Europe, Turkey, and also more easy to research, and that's how I became interested in Turkish studies at the very beginning. That was back in the 90s, 1990s. And then actually it's interesting how I became interested in mukhtars, because I did my master's thesis on Uzbekistan for, I don't remember for which reasons back then, because Turkish studies, I had also kind of, I take courses in Central Asian studies. And so I did some research on Uzbekistan, and I studied there actually the neighborhoods. And it was in the 90s. It was shortly after Uzbekistan had become independent. And there was a kind of this a big, state building period. And there, what had interested me is how the official institutions tried to grasp the unofficial neighborhood organizations that were very powerful in Uzbekistan. And so I had this interest in that kind of interplay between state institutions and social institutions and how they had become officialized and institutionalized in the kind of administrative hierarchy. And that's actually the way I became then interested in mukhtars in Turkey too, because then I decided to work more on Turkey and to leave Central Asia. And I realized that we had actually kind of similar things in Turkey with mukhtars and neighborhoods, mahalles, which are in Uzbekistan, mahallas. So at the beginning, I was very astonished because I had this, kind of idea that the Turkish state is a very strong state, is a very bureaucratic state, is a very established state. And you know, in Uzbekistan, it was, as I said, this period of state building, new institutions being created, trying to, you know, grasp on what they was considered as traditional structures, etc. But it was not the same situation in Turkey. Turkey was very much, you know, old state established, and so I was struck by that. And that more generally, the reason why I became interested in Muhtars and those neighborhood headmen is because this general opinion that the Turkish state is very strong, is a very, you know, autonomous from society, this is a very widespread idea. Also in the academic literature, and what I had seen in my previous researches, for example, on the Alevi movements or other research on the MPs and parties, I was not very convinced that the Turkish state was so much, you know, autonomous from society, very like imposing some order on society. I was not very satisfied with that. And also with some colleagues of mine, historians, sociologists, geographers, etc., who were many wanting to question that idea. And then we launched a broader project on the, well, basically on patterns of governance in Turkey and the late Ottoman Empire. This is a book, actually. It became a book. In my personal research, I decided to work really on Muhtars because it was, you know, about questioning the autonomy of the Turkish state in relationship with society. So I wanted to look precisely at where the state meets society. And then I think the Muhtars were interesting for me in that respect because they were very versatile connection points because they deal also with different areas of activity. They are not specialized, you know, in some domain. And you know, they are kind of a multifunctional bridge or something between, or connection point between state and society. And there I also wanted to look at the, you know, how citizens in Turkey experience the state on an everyday basis. I wanted to go beyond, you know, looking at state-society relations. This questioning in terms of state-society relations is very interesting and has been worked on very much. But mostly it has been worked on, you know, by looking at conflictual settings or like, for example, in the Kurdish provinces or conflict areas, etc. I wanted to look at the everyday where nothing really happens, but, you know, the normal kind of everyday battle, ordinary kind of experiencing of the state and how people deal with the institutions. And there I found that Muhtars were actually quite interesting entry perspective into that broader questioning, because actually the questioning of the book is on state society relations and what I call governing from below. And so that was how I became interested in Muhtars, and the more I did this research, the more I became interested, actually, because I was not expecting at the beginning the richness of what I would actually observe on the ground.
Well, so before we get into what you observed on the ground, maybe you can give a little explanation of Muhtars. What is this position, and what has it been historically up till, say, the early 2000s, the aughts, when you started doing your research?
Yeah, actually, what is striking also is that Muhtar, or let's say the institution of Muhtarlık, is probably the oldest still functioning institution in Turkey, because it has been created in the 1830s and it still exists and works today, operates very differently, of course. But it's striking because, Ottoman and Turkish history has gone through so many ruptures, and institutions have broken down so many times, and you see this continuity. And so this also struck me. So what are they? This is a very basic question, but actually not so basic. Let me explain. Actually, what interests me is that Mukhtars actually don't fit really into any box. They don't fit in the classical categories of political sociology. And that's also what interested me. And I call them hybrids at some point, I think, in the book. Because in the 1830s, in the course of, you know, big reforms in the Ottoman Empire, reforms of the administrative apparatus, and the formation of new bureaucratic formalities and the reconfiguration of state hierarchies. This was part of this broader trend. And so the formation of Mukhtarlık is broadly analyzed in the literature in terms of bureaucratization and sometimes also modernization. And because actually from the beginning, Mukhtars were kind of, you know, connected to the state apparatus because their functions, most of their functions actually was linked to the central authorities. So basically they were kind of officials on the very, on the ground, on the very local level, like on the neighborhood level or village level, with a strong connection to the state. And so their main responsibility from the quite the beginning, actually, there was some, you know, developments, but basically it has a big continuity. And their main responsibility was to ensure order in the neighborhood or in the village and safety. And so also to denounce suspect people or, suspect activities to security forces. And also they had to implement the laws and the regulations. And they had, after a while, they have been responsible for keeping the civil records, etc., etc. So they seem to be, you know, this fits very much in this broad history of modernization of the state, like the state becoming also organized in a very low, at a very local level. And so that is one dimension, but that is only one dimension of the, what Mukhtars are. Because what interested me is that they are not really, I mean, they are not strictly speaking bureaucrats, at least not in the Weberian sense. They have many, many things differ from bureaucrats. First, because they, for decades, they have not been paid. They had no salary, which was actually not an exception for Ottoman officials. Many Ottoman officials did not have kind of what we would interpret as a salary. But after a while, the salary for officials became a rule in the Ottoman Empire, but not for Mukhtars. And then under the Republic, they also had no salary until the 70s. So as a consequence, it means that Mukhtars are, you know, they have other means of getting paid, or other professional activities. So they are not specialized. No, they are not kind of professionals like we would expect from a bureaucrat. And another very important dimension is that they are elected by the local people, by the inhabitants, the residents of the neighborhood or the village. So basically, they are administrators of the electors, which is a very complicated position. So they are temporary also because of being elected. They are temporary. And from this perspective, Mukhtars, look like more like elected officials, like municipal councillors or something like this. But again, they are different from those kind of elected, you know, politicians or officials. And for example, they don't have the authority to represent their population, the population of their neighborhood. And they also don't have any more, a party affiliation since 1980, since the coup, actually. So they are not normal, like local elected people. They are a kind of in between, you know, position at the very local level, so very much embedded in local society, but still very much connected to the state. And so I think this is what what interested me at the beginning. So this is intriguing, this situation, I found that at least. But this also raises interesting scientific questions. And especially what aroused my interest most is related to the fact that Mukhtars are precisely situated at the very intersection of bottom-up and top-down logics. So I thought this made them a very heuristic observation point for understanding the state-society relations. And also, this is a kind of figure that I studied in Turkey, but there are actually many of such, you know, figures of local intermediaries in the Middle East and actually also beyond the Middle East. In the post-Ottoman world, you find Mukhtars in several places. You found Mukhtars in Lebanon, you found Mukhtars in Cyprus, you found Mukhtars in Iraq, and with some differences also in other places. So, and this very, you know, very local intermediaries have hardly been studied in the literature. I think they are very important in the everyday making of states and politics in those places. So more broadly, I wanted to try to grasp this and to look at this.
Well, you know, in describing Mukhtars, you even refer to them as notables, which, you know, sometimes in Middle East studies, notable conjures up this idea of powerful, you know, local elite figure. But you're getting at something a little more precise with the term. So maybe you can discuss this idea of Mukhtars as notables. And how do you see it illustrated in their relationships with their neighborhood and electorate? Who are Mukhtars? What makes them notables?
Yeah, that's a good question. It was one of the questions that made me busy for years, maybe. One of the main reasons why I call them notables, I call them small notables, but is that they are two dimensions of related. They are related. The first dimension is that Mukhtars are embedded in society. That's what very interested me, the social embeddedness of the state and what that produces in political terms. And the role of the Mukhtar is precisely defined by the Mukhtar's proximity with the residents and his embeddedness in the local society. So this is, of course, a geographical proximity because the Mukhtar is supposed to live in the neighborhood. This is also a social proximity because the Mukhtars are not like very much educated people, or they are not elite kind of elite people. They are, you know, not anybody, but they are also not the very top of the society, even of the local society. Most of them are, you know, quite, you know, close to socially in terms of education, in terms of occupation, quite close to the society of their neighborhood. And this is also a relational proximity. And this is very key for me, this relational proximity. What I mean by this is the social connectedness. Mukhtar's role for the state institutions is to be much connected to the society, and that they have the possibility to get information about anything that happens in the neighborhood or village. Even if they don't know all the people directly, to get, you know, to have some information through a limited number of intermediaries. And this is crucial. This is crucial because this is where we understand the very specificity of the Mukhtar or similar figures. Like the Mukhtar, in his role, is to provide, for example, certificates, especially certificates of residency or poverty certificates, and to prove the status of individuals in the neighborhood, and to prove that to different state institutions. So the Mukhtar basically delivers certificates. So how does the Mukhtar do that? He does that on the basis of his evaluation of each case, on the basis of his supposed knowledge of the people and their daily life and life conditions. So basically, this is very different from what we have in, for example, many European societies, where you have to prove, for example, how much you earn and your status by official, papers and documents. Because basically, the Mukhtar issues those documents. So he is a production, he is a productor of official documents, and it is on the basis of his experiential knowledge of the people, relationship to the people. So they play a key role in the official certification of the state of things and people. And this is important, especially also in a context where a significant amount of social phenomena are not, officially registered or are undeclared, like undeclared work, undeclared buildings, and so on. And so this experience, this is important in order to understand to what extent the Turkish state actually relies on experiential knowledge of those kind of elected individual and not only on registered, standardized, computerized knowledge. And I think this is very important. Now I come back to your question on notables. Sorry. So what I wanted to stress with that word of notables is twofold. First, what I just said, the relational dimension of their work and the importance of their relationship to their world in terms of social connectedness. That's the first dimension, and that's also, the basic definition of the notables is also their social ambiguousness. And the second dimension is their function as an intermediary between state institutions, let's say, and society. And this is a more like organizational dimension, an organizational definition of notables. That's what I wanted also to stress, the fact that relationship with the state may be mediated, maybe not only, again, based on general regulations, rules, and laws, and data, but also mediated by individuals and by individuals that people elect, which is important. This will, and also it is to use the term of notables, which has been so much used in literature, especially on the Middle East, is also a way to stress continuities with the past. Because if you look at historiography on Turkey, you see that the concept of notables is hardly used anymore, because basically notables are considered to be something of the past, something that disappeared with the modernization of Turkey and bureaucratization, etc. And I don't think this is, I think this is only part of the picture. So I wanted to stress another part of the picture. And in that respect, I was very much inspired by the works of Michael Minker, for example, who studied the continuity of notables and dynasties of notables, and how they mediate these different dimensions of state society, party society relations. And so he stopped his work in the 60s, so I wanted to, to stress those continuities, but also I don't want to essentialize, this dimension. And part of the book is about, how Mukhtars are this kind of very local intermediaries, but basically the broader context is bureaucratized and is computerized, etc. So how this works together, because it does work together. So how this basic, reflection, and many people think that Mukhtars should disappear now. We have computers and etc. Data, databases, etc. And so they are not functional anymore, and they are considered as a kind of remain of the past, but that should disappear in the next years or And this is an argument that comes over and over again. And actually, Muhtar had been disappeared from official institutions in the 1930s, in the very hard period of modernization of the one-party regime. And that was a law prohibiting Muhtar and saying, you know, like now we have a kind of working municipal administration, so we don't need Muhtars anymore. And what is very interesting is that there were so many things that were not functioning that they reintroduced Muhtars after 10 years or so in 1944. So there was this idea that Muhtars are, you know, something of the past, but that didn't work without them. So it's interesting to see that, you know, that episode. And now this discourse of Muhtars, you know, they are remain of the past and they will disappear. Did you hear this over and over again? But that's not what I observed, because what I observed is that they are still very much, you know, asked for by people and even by state institutions that, you know, rely on them, on their knowledge. And so they are, in a way, I don't like this word because I'm not a functionalist, but they have some functions that they are considered useful by lots of people. And so they work in interplay with this general landscape of databases and computerized modes of governing people. But they still have a role there. And it, of course, it changed and it is changing, but it hasn't disappeared. And I'm not sure it will disappear in the next years, but we will see.
You know, when you're saying this, it reminds me, though, there's a follow-up I think I'd like to ask you, which is that, so before someone becomes a Muhtar, before they step into this role and start performing these functions, what sort of jobs do people do before they become Muhtars? You're not born into it, are you? What sort of social positions, social roles are they performing before their position starts?
Yeah, that's a good question, because as I just said, that not anybody becomes a Muhtar, but it was not very precise. Actually, it's interesting because they get elected by the residents. So they have to win an election, and they are not supposed to run on a party ticket. They don't run on party tickets, even if they may have some relationships with parties. So that means that they are elected as individuals. So how can you be elected in a village or a neighborhood with, the size of the number of residents can really vary from like 200 to like 80,000. Of course, it's not the same kind of election. But then you have to be well known. The first thing is that, you know, if you're not a nobody, it's very hard to be elected a Muhtar. Maybe it's important to say that these elections are very competitive. There are many, many people who want to become Muhtars. So it's a very fierce competition in most places. So that's also important to keep in mind, because we tend to consider that position as unimportant, very low level, etc. But still, it seems to be a desirable position. So coming back to your question, what do they do? So that you have to be well known. You have to be known a little bit and have a good reputation. So you're not born into it, but actually it is quite often that it becomes that Muhtarlık is a family issue. It is quite often that Muhtarlık is inherited from, you know, in the family, from father to son or daughter to uncle and nephew, etc. It is quite often. It's not always the case, but still, I mean, and he who becomes a Muhtarlık, mostly people either from important families. When I say important families, again, it's not the richest, it's not the most educated, but it's like settled families in the neighborhoods. Of course, depending on the social composition of the neighborhoods, this has different meanings or different variations. But basically, if you are in neighborhoods, I worked only in Istanbul, I worked only on urban neighborhoods. I didn't, the book is not about village Muhtars. In Istanbul, if you are in a neighborhood with many people, where many people have come from, you know, the provinces, which is the case of the most neighborhoods in Istanbul, then Muhtars are people, you know, from the first families that were settled here, there, so in the 60s or 70s, basically. So settled families and families and people who have contacts, who are known because they have links to the people. So as in terms of occupations, this means, for example, use many grocers becoming Muhtars or people doing real estate like agencies or people that are on everyday basis in contact with people and giving services to people or sometimes also another profile of Muhtars is people getting involved before becoming Muhtars, getting involved in like associations of the neighborhood or association of their hometown association like Hemşehri, Dernekleri, as they say, Turkish, or you know, the people that are active, you know, and in everyday life in the and in contact with and relationship with people and quite well off people actually, because you have to do a campaign. And this is sometimes a little bit, you know, expensive depending on the size of the neighborhood. So, well, different, several, but not anybody can become a Muhtar. And they have to get have a good reputation. And also, what makes their profile also different from other elected people, like municipal councillor, is that it relies very much on their individual, like, sources. And what is always the case, if Muhtars are elected, people that are able to be elected Muhtars are people who are able to build local coalitions in the local society. So this means they have this ability before becoming Muhtars. And so you see that they are elected on the cleavages, on localized cleavages, that are not the same than the municipal elections, for example. It's very interesting because Muhtars are elected at the very same day with the other local elected people, like the municipal councillors or mayors and so on. But what you say, if you look at the statistics, it's not a copy of the party political results. There are other logics, other dynamics. And so this election is only partly because there are still, you know, sometimes party political dimensions, but it's a not kind of partly autonomous level of very local politics, related, but loosely related to party politics, sometimes more, sometimes less. But still, you know, and here you have very localized issues, and that's makes it very interesting because it's partly autonomous and very hard to research also, because in every single place it may be different. And also because what I didn't say at the beginning, there are no records of, you know, Muhtars activities and elections. There are no data, they are not published data on Muhtars election. So it's challenging actually to research. And so as you asked me about the kind of occupations that people have before becoming Muhtars, well, you know, there is no aggregated data, so it is always challenging to try to find an answer to those kind of questions. And we don't have, you know, like statistics or so, but so it's documentation is kind of an issue for this kind of question.
Well, so the way you describe them, these Muhtars, they're socially close to the neighborhoods in which they're located, and at the same time, their role is to communicate the issues in that neighborhood, the interests in that neighborhood, upwards. So they're in this middle position. So how do you see them negotiating these pressures they're feeling from the people around them and the people above them in order to create these coalitions that you say are necessary for them? How do they do this? What strategies do they use?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I started actually my research with the question in mind. So they're in between state and society. Do they act as, representatives of the state, like implementing state interests on society, or on the contrary, do they operate as channels of the people and representing the interests and the demands of the people? This is a very hard question. I ended up changing actually my questioning in the end in the book I finished by trying to understand what is the politics, but what does it produce in political terms, this kind of governing, what does that produce? But in order to answer your question, yeah, I think it's a very, they are dealing all the time. This is, first, it is important to know that mutas are not very much controlled by the official hierarchy. It's little codified what they have to do, etc. There are no records. They have some kind of, kind of freedom in, to a certain extent. But the way mukhtars operate it, and the way citizens use the mukhtars or have recourse to the mukhtars, this is very flexible. They are negotiating pressures from below and from the bottom. But in order to understand the specificity, you see that the relationship that mukhtars have with their citizens is a very, or let's say the other way around, the relations that citizens have with the mukhtar are quite different from the relations that people have with all the public agents. So, because mukhtars are the only public officials, let's say the public officials on whom local inhabitants can exercise some form of power, so for form of pressure, much more than on a mayor or municipal councillor, because also they see them every day on the street and so on. So, of course, then mukhtars are indebted to their inhabitants, to the electors, and they have, integrated the imperative of satisfying their inhabitants. So they, mukhtars, they do not behave like field bureaucrats, at least when you observe them on the street, in the everyday. But they present themselves always as serving the inhabitants. So, and this has very concrete effects. For example, while mukhtars are supposed officially to enforce the laws and regulations, they do not always show much diligence in this task. For example, they are supposed to denounce, irregularities, etc. But mostly, they don't always denounce. At least they don't denounce everything, every irregularity that they know. They have the power to do so. But of course, if they do so too much, probably they won't be reelected because, as you know, everybody has something to hide. So, and mukhtars know many things about, local people. So they have, in a way, what I observed is that sometimes they really protect sometimes people from state regulations. Or, for example, they would at some points, not, as I said, not denounce or inform people about what they risk as sanctions if they do this and that, and that they should be cautious, not as a, but in order to protect the people. So they would, operate as rendering services to the people. And this is precisely for this reason that people resort to the mukhtars. I think what is also striking, and what I was saying when I was mentioning that mukhtars are still very functional, even in a very bureaucratized environment, is that people recourse precisely to the mukhtar because of this specific relationship. That is, mukhtars are, they are considered as in some kind of part of the state, but also neighbors, and so somebody that you can ask help, or you can ask some support, or you can explain your situation when it doesn't fit in the boxes, in the official boxes, which is very often. And so mukhtars are one of the privileged recourses of people in their strategies for circumventing the rules. So that's really important to understand that. It's precisely because of that broader, bureaucratized, sometimes oppressive context. So Mukhtars, but it is also important to keep in mind that Mukhtars cannot always defend the people, and that even if they perform as always helping the people, that's not always what they do. So they have, you know, they have a very hard position, I must say. And so they have to, you know, keep the confidence of the institutions like municipality, like governorship, etc., with whom they have to work at the same time. So they have, you know, to not circumvent the rules too much or not do it too openly. So it's always a play on what is visible and what is invisible, a play on formality and informality. And I found this interesting because, you know, because what I could observe there is informal politics in a very official state institutions. So that is really striking because, you know, when much of the literature on, you know, low politics or informal politics, etc., looks actually at situations and settings outside the state institutions. And here, my challenge was to look at that in the very scope of state institution. Okay, this is a specific state institution, but still. And here I could see much circumventing and informality happening. And so that was very interesting to me, to what extent Mukhtars actually very regularly bend the official order. At least they are expected by the people, by much of the people to be able to bend the order. And it is, in the book, there is a chapter circumventing the rules and how Mukhtars are expected, because of this image that they perform, they are expected to give some privileges to the people and help them. And I document this with analyzing the payment of the fees that people are supposed to pay when the Mukhtar issues a document or a declaration. And there is a constant play and negotiation of the fees. And so here is fascinating because you see that to what extent the fee, which is an official fee, it is written on the walls, it is regulated by the Ministry of Interior or by the governorship. And it's, even if it's written on the wall, you know, it becomes part of a negotiation of this relationship of the Mukhtars with the people. And so this is fascinating to see this, how this social negotiation becomes part of officiality. And one of the conclusions of the book is that Mukhtars are a kind of a face of the state, to take up the title of the book of Yael Nagaboyashi. Is one face of the state, not the only one. But this is a very specific face of the state because this is an amicable, this is a human kind of face of the state. This and they're performing as, you know, helping the inhabitants. This gives the impression that you can negotiate with the Turkish state. And this actually allows to some extent, kinds of negotiation and arrangements with the official institutions. And I think this is one of the conclusions of the book, is that this is actually institutionalized as such in the Turkish state.
Well, so this brings me to the last thing I really wanted to talk about, which is the changes that have happened the last, say, two decades. On the one hand, you've mentioned already that there's computerized aspects. So maybe first, I'd like us to talk a little about how Mukhtars have reacted to this computerization of their jobs, and how are they maintaining this informality you're talking about, given that?
Yeah, I think... for Muhtar's, it has been complicated, this computerization. First, because, they are not very fond of computers, so to say. Because, their way of working is more about orality, etc. They are not, very... Their education level is much lower than, for example, much lower than any bureaucrats, but also lower than municipal councillors and so on. So they are not very at ease with those tools. So, but they had to, get into that, and that's not always easy. But what is very interesting here is that it's important to keep in mind that computerization is a way to grasp reality. Social reality that has limits, and those limits are important. And so what happens is that Muhtar felt some kind of deprivation with this trends to computerization, registers, for example, of people, computerized registers, etc. And their workload has decreased. Actually, their workload has decreased. On the one hand, this was a good news for them because some Muhtars have in the big neighborhoods have a very big workload. But on the other hand, this has also big inconvenience for Muhtars is that the most money they were able to earn back then is the fees from the official documents that they issued. So if they issue less documents, this means less revenue. So it was very ambiguous. But what is important to me is that many people, citizens, try to... it's important that you have this bureaucratization, computerization, but it's only partly. For example, if you want to get some certificates, you can do that on the internet, and many people do that on the internet when they are able to use, these computerized things and platforms and so on. But many people don't feel that they can do that. So they feel uneasy with these things. And you can still get your certificates and official documents from the Muhtar. So both are coexisting. So it has not disappeared. But it's interesting to see that if you want to get those documents from the Muhtars, you have to pay. But again, as I said, you can negotiate the payment. But still, even if you have to pay, many people tend to prefer going to the Muhtar for the documents than going into a computer where they feel uneasy and they don't understand and so on. And so there is a kind of, computer literacy issue here also. So then people still recourse to the Muhtars for that. But what is even more interesting to me is that the official institutions also recourse to the Muhtars, because now that data about the people are much more computerized than before with very broad databases and so on. But still, as I said, there are many things that are not recorded in this databases. And so it is very often that Muhtars get called by, it can be police officers. I saw several instances of that. For example, police officers tracking people without being able to locate them and asking the Muhtars, does that person really live here and where, and can call him or her, etc. And it's very striking. Police officer or even intelligence people also, because the knowledge, because Muhtars are supposed to have real knowledge. When I say real, I mean based on experience, everyday experience and reputation, and also gossip also of the people. And so and this is actually sometimes considered as more better knowledge than what is recorded. So it's important to keep in mind that even official institutions have recourse to the Muhtars for their testimony. And so as they are still considered as a very trustful not very trustworthy. They are still considered as a source of information and as complementary to that computerized databases that are not always considered as you know, something you can trust.
Well, so the final question I'd like to ask, you know, we've gone for about 50 minutes without mentioning the Justice and Development Party, I believe, which is, I think, impressive for a discussion of contemporary Turkey. But probably we shouldn't hold to that. I think it would be worth discussing. There's been a government now that's been in power for about 20 years. And so you suggest that there is something of a coherent Muhtar policy that the AKP has been pursuing. Can we conclude maybe by you talking a bit about this and what its effects are, how we can see it playing out?
Yeah, actually, yes, there has been a coherent Muhtar policy, but not for the whole period of the AKP in power. It has been on a very specific time, and this is, again, important in order to understand what that means. Actually, this has, I would say, this has begun at in the early 2010s, so, and for a few years, and very specifically, this is a period where there was a Gezi movement, and this Gezi movement, of course, fueled the kind of politicization of local issues and urban governance in general. So, and then it was this Muhtar policy actually happened when Erdogan became the president in 2014 and in the years just before and just after. And so what is it about? Actually, there is a symbolic, when I say symbolic, it's not only symbolic, but what happened and was very much widespread in the media and so on is that Erdogan, when he became the president, he began to organize very big Muhtar meetings, gathering like 400, 500 Muhtars every month at the presidency palace and giving some kind of speeches to them. And the speeches being, you know, recorded on the media and commented also in the media, etc. And speeches actually about general policy, not really on Muhtar issues mainly. And so this was very interesting because this the aim of this was actually, he was to receive all Muhtars. So Muhtars are about 50,000, all Muhtars in a few years. And this policy actually stopped in late 2018. And it was not, the ambition was not totally done because probably they, about half of the Muhtars, 20,000, 25,000 Muhtars were received, which is again a very big achievement, actually, which is a very big achievement. And so what's interesting is that Muhtars are considered in Turkey as a not very, you know, prestigious position, it's a, especially among politicians. I mean, this is the lowest level, so they are considered as, you know, not very valuable. And so it was striking, it was the first time a president ever bothered to, you know, consider the Muhtars. And so in a very also prestigious setting and so on, and also in his discourses saying how important the Muhtars were because they were the basis of democracy as being elected in a very local level, very close to the people. And so he tried also to give some very big value to their work. And that was first in Turkish history, actually. And so it's very, very interesting because as I began my research in the early 2010s, it was before that these Muhtar meetings. And many of my colleagues didn't really understand why I was interested in Muhtars, because they seem so unimportant and so have no power and so on. So I always had to explain why I was interested in Muhtars and how it was important and so on. And then after Erdogan began doing this Muhtar meeting, then nobody actually asked me anymore because they, well, to a certain extent, Erdogan gave me right, actually. So even if his interest in Muhtar's is different than mine, probably. So what I want to see here is say here is that this symbolic importance he gave to Muhtar is was actually a way of for I think for Erdogan to perform as being close to the people and also to also have this dimension of, you know, spreading his word to the Turkish people, because it was like a very big audience and also he was asking the Muhtars to spread his word into their neighborhoods or villages, and this was on the media everywhere and so on. So it was a very big opportunity to perform this present of the people kind of image. But beyond that, there was another dimension of this policy, which actually was about binding the Muhtars more to the state and especially to the executive. And why do I say that? Because in that period, the allowance of the Muhtars was increased very much. It was for the first time it became. It became more than the minimum wage, which before it was really a very, very low allowance that was much lower than the minimum wage, which meant that you can't, you know, really make a living out of this. But now it has become, you know, like the, a little bit more than the minimum wage. So, and so this has made the Muhtars in a way more, bound to the state and less financially bound to the fees that the residents pay to them. So this has increased the dependency of the Muhtars to the state apparatus and state rationales. And so there have been other measures like in improving their working conditions, improving their social security, etc., etc. Rationale of this policy was to take Muhtars as relays of the state more than it was before. And actually Erdogan also say that in his speeches that he was expecting from Muhtars to denounce terrorists and so on. This was especially, I mean, the also the period of the end of the peace process, etc., with the Kurdish issue, and so it was a very, very tense period. And so taking the Muhtars as the relays of the state, and so this was actually important. And there is another dimension to this, which is, I think, broader and also older, is that I had said that Muhtars are not bound, officially and totally, to party rationales, but because actually state institutions have become more politicized in the course of the AKP period, as AKP was becoming, you know, hegemonic in every single state institution, also in the bureaucracy and so on. This also had effects on Muhtars, because Muhtars actually, I didn't say that before, but they have no budget, they have no means. The only thing they can do for the people is to channel resources, but these resources are the municipal resources or resources of the governorships. They are Muhtars are only channels, and that's why they have to keep good relationships with those other institutions, which are the resource providers. And so, with those institutions becoming overwhelmingly dominated by the AKP, this had also this was incentives for Muhtars. It was hard to be very autonomous from party politics and the AKP. And so this was also another kind of dimension of this broader development. So what happened now is this, I think there has been a very, in the last years, a politicization of the Muhtar institution, and Muhtar had been quite autonomous from party rationales between the 1980s and I would say late 2000s, but now I wouldn't be so assertive, and I would say that this autonomy has decreased actually, and this has made the Muhtar position even harder. It is not only between state and society, but also party politics, and this is a very tense position to be held into this Turkey.
Well, thank you. That's very interesting food for thought. Let me just conclude by asking. This book is out. It's published. People can go and read it, and I think they should, because there's lots of specific, interesting details that you include in it about these different sites that you looked at, these different mukhtars you talked to throughout the city of Istanbul. So I really enjoyed reading it and hope people will also go and read it. With this out, though, what is the project you're working on now? What are you going to be doing next?
Yeah, well, actually, I began working on another project, and this is a collective project about the production. It's called Production of Electoral Truths. It studies the ways in which electoral truths or the trust in elections is produced or not through material, technological, and political dynamics. So It actually, this project starts from the statement that elections in many parts of the world have now a very big technicality, and there are observers and so on. They are controlled everywhere, but this doesn't lead to a greater adherence to the results. So this is about questioning the complexity of the making of the trust in the electoral results. And here I study the Turkish dimension of this process, which is interesting because the trust in election has decreased in Turkey in the last 10 years, I would say, more or less. And here we have very interesting parallels with the United States, with Brazil, with Kenya, with many parts of the world. So this is a broader kind of trend. But I began actually interesting in this making of the electoral truths by actually working on mukhtars, because they play a very big role in organizing the elections at several stages. And so there is actually kind of continuity between both projects. But So I looked at basically at the multiple actors involved in the organization and control of elections. So parties, bureaucracies, mukhtars, experts, judges, etc., NGOs, of course, like observation NGOs, and voters themselves. And so this is a new project, and I am looking forward to doing the field research on that, and we'll keep you informed about the book to come out in 10 years or so.
Well, I mean, the next year promises to be a very interesting one for doing research during.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk about your book. I really enjoyed reading it. And I'm happy to talk to you. I hope other people will take the time as well to read it. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.